What we've been talking about here is the difference between sight and vision. Now, Oscar, I'm going to give you an assist on this one because this is a definite two-handed maneuver. What I'm going to, so I'll describe it first. What I'm going to ask you to do is, first of all, tell me, do you see relatively clearly, close to 20/20, or as close as you can get with your glasses on?
Yes.
Okay, yeah.
Except for small print.
Except for things
that are like close.
Yeah, okay. So in other words, you feel like you can see to walk around. Okay, that's the idea of having sight. The idea of vision and vision processing skills is going to be examined here, because what I'm going to ask you to do is place this post-it pad against your forehead and write your name.
Okay. Well, I write so badly anyway that okay. I'm sure I can't do it. Let's see.
That's the edge, right?
Do we dare look?
Sure, as soon as you're done, take a look and see what you've done.
I'm doing it backwards, aren't I?
Well, it looks like I'm pretty sure.
Whoa. Okay, Dwayne, you went the right direction.
I got the right direction. Yeah. It looks like about a third grade or a 33-year-old.
Well, yeah, but we got the direction and we didn't have any letters inverted or...
Not even the end. Now that...
You got the right direction and the end.
Yeah, the end's backwards.
You got the slant. I'm going to hold the wrong way.
What about that? I slant the wrong direction. Here's the F, I guess.
I'm pretty sure I was doing it. I'm pretty sure. I was pretty sure that I was doing it backwards, but that was the...
Yeah, that's the
same
thing.
It's an example of what you call a visual processing skill. It's still a visually controlled ability, but it has a great deal to do with difference, not what we call laterality, which is your left and which is your right. Now, I did that as my left and my right. Directionality means you had to sit there and say, I see that's her left hand and that's her right hand, and be able to flip it for the other person.
I'm normally, really, would be right-handed.
Would be right-handed.
Would I have done it correctly if I... Right,
it's hard to say. Yeah, that'd be a real interesting question. We could pass them around and everybody do it with their left hand. And we might get an immediate response.
Our own little survey.
But I have to do it with my right hand because I am left-handed.
Okay. I think that often what happens, I know that what happens with children as they are trying to learn is they are dealing with left and right. And often they don't have that distinction clearly in mind. And the one thing I meant to do, and I didn't, would someone bring the chalkboard around?
Sure. Oh, I will let
you. Oh, we were stuck on that.
What is this? This is on vision and learning. Oh, I'm sorry, just a little bit back this way so that the screen is clear. That's it.
Like that? Thank you. Around farther?
If you can all see it, then it's good enough for me. Okay. If you write, or if anyone, as they learn to print, the letter B, you go down and you make a loop to the right. You have to be very clear that that's what happens when you make a B, and that your loop is to the left to make a D. Now, for some of these people who do not have a clear-cut distinction of laterality, which is a visual skill, there is no difference to them. And so they randomly come out with a B or a D, kind of interchangeably. The others that are most frequently goofed up are the P's and the G or the Q effect. Another one that does happen though, I write my numbers a little bit differently, but 6 and 9, the way I write them, it's even more so, like it's exactly upside down. Now, I think what I'd like to do is give you, first of all, a partial quote out of a letter that was written by Margie Thompson. Margie Thompson is now the president of a group called PAVE. PAVE stands for Parents Active for Vision Education. And it's a national organization based in San Diego and really attempting to do the same thing that I'm doing in a different way. And they've done some very, very good work. There's just a few, you know, philosophical differences, but we coordinate. What she has to say, until last year, the school district regarded our son as retarded, and they had the test to prove it. Josh, age 11, did not read or count. His speech was terrible, and his coordination was very low. On IQ tests, he scored in the 70s, with some subscores less than 10. But we believed he was not retarded, and last year Josh was exonerated. Josh was found to have vision skills so poor that it fell in the less than 5% range. We learned that the school district knew of Josh's poor vision skills 6 years ago, but despite the law, chose to label him as mildly retarded and placed him in a special day class. The coordinator of special education for the school district, when I asked why vision skills problems weren't addressed earlier, replied, "I don't believe in vision therapy." Josh had 62 hours of vision therapy, and the improvement is amazing. His vision has improved 4 to 6 years. That would, she's talking on developmental skills that he should have had. His eyes are just beginning to work together, and last week he had his first experience with depth perception. Josh is learning to read and write, and his speech is better. Josh has always gone to school and tuned out. Now he's learning to pay attention and to be responsible for classwork and homework. As his skills are extremely low and his speech is poor, he has no friends in junior high school and eats lunch every day alone. Had his poor vision been corrected earlier, his life would be much better today. We are thrilled that we have found the source of Josh's problems and are correcting his vision and doing everything possible to help him catch up with his peers. That was not Margie's. That was another mother's letter. Margie's own child was in sixth grade and had a great deal of difficulty, and I will leave her letter. There were two letters, and I unfortunately read the wrong one as if it was Margie's. As I mentioned yesterday, I had my own visual skills problem, and the part where I talked about having the first episode of depth perception, I can relate to, and I'd like to tell you a little bit just what that is like, as well as I can in my terms. As I was doing vision exercises that were enabling me to use both eyes and have them point at the same point in time, point in space at the same time, I was able to do that on this little card that they gave me, and I wore a red lens over one eye and a green lens over the other eye, and this card had a red image and a green image that were offset from one another. Okay, and it was my job, because the red lens would make the red image disappear for that eye. The green lens would make the green image on the page disappear for the other eye. So each eye then had an isolated image, and it was my job to make those two images, which work together, come together. And it seemed impossible at first, but gradually you start to play with your system and to blink and to do whatever you can, and finally learn that you do have the ability to move the images and to make the muscles of your eyes respond in it's kind of like, I suppose, learning to walk when you're a child. Learning to make those muscles respond in the way they need to in order to do what you want to do. So I would look at these cards, and as the two images came together, one of the effects of it was that would result in some depth perception, and on the card they were designed to look like if you were in a movie where they had the 3D glasses effect, okay? So I was sitting outside looking at these things, working my eyes, and they had little round circles as part of it. And there was an outer circle and an inner circle. And if I had them properly lined up, the inner circle would either appear to rise toward me from the card, or the outer circle, depending on what the exercise was at that time. Well, I was at that time it was the inner circle that would rise, and I was sitting there, I was looking at the circles, and sure enough, I could see it start to come up off the card, and I thought, this is okay, this is kind of neat, this is what he said to do. And I got curious that day, and I said, well, what would happen if instead of looking at this card, I look at the wheelbarrow over there, and we had a young kitten, and just use my eyes in the same way on these objects in real space that I'm using them. So I sat and I looked at the wheelbarrow for a period of seconds, and what was basically flat just kind of came out like that, you know, and just kind of, it was like gradual growing, and I was going, oh, that's really neat. Look what I did. I felt pretty good about myself. And of course, then it went away, and I finished my exercises for the day. I was doing 15 to 20 minutes of sometimes a half an hour concentrated vision exercises in the morning, and then put it away each day, with the exception of, well, 5 or 6 days a week is what I was doing. So that was probably 9 or 10 in the morning. And about 2 o'clock that afternoon, I was on my way running around town finishing errands before I needed to teach piano lessons. And I was driving the car when my body decided to fuse and give me depth perception. And it's very interesting. Fortunately, I knew what was happening to me. But I was driving, and all at once, it felt as if the world was rushing past me on all sides. And I knew that I felt very out of control. And like I definitely was in a territory that I'd never been in before. So I pulled the car over immediately and stopped it. And it was right next to my friend's bakery. So I got out of the car and went into the bakery and said, Anne, you won't believe this, but I'm looking at you differently than I've ever seen you before. You kind of stand out against the background now. Interestingly enough, she didn't look very clear. She was blurry. I hadn't fine-tuned anything yet, but I did have that sense of seeing her in relief. Of course, she might have been blurry because I think I was getting teary about that time. So I went back out to the car, got in, and kind of cautiously started driving. No repeat of that initial thing. I've never had that happen since, and I since have put it together that what I was really doing, instead of the world rushing by me, in effect, what I was really sensing was my own movement through space. And it gives meaning to the words that the behavioral optometrists use called lost in space, where the person literally isn't real sure where they are. And that tends to make you rather tentative. One of the things that happen with depth perception and good binocularity is that I never knew how close the ground is. I always thought it was much further away. And that would explain why in my first eye exam, the doctor said, I bet you don't like heights very much, do you? I said, no, I don't. Well, I couldn't tell where the ground was. And sometimes if I was out feeding my horses and had to climb up in the hay bales to get the highest bale and throw some over, then I was supposed to hop down to the ground. Mm-hmm. And I could never tell where it was. And so sometimes I would say, okay, I don't want to just jump. And I don't feel very secure at all, so I would look and I would study the ground very carefully. And the harder I looked at it, the more it would seem to kind of rise and fall a little bit. And I couldn't get a fix on it. It was really worse than not trying to find out where the ground was. So eventually I would just say, oh, I'm sure my knees will bend when I hit it anyway. And I would hop and trust that my body would react by the kinesthetic sense of hitting the ground. So what I was as a child was one of the very last to be chosen for a team. We played basketball in my girlfriend's
backyard, the hoop in front of the garage. And we chose teams. We had neighborhood kids all the same age. And I was always about next to the last, you know, on the... And I knew I tried really hard, and I knew sometimes I made baskets, you know, but you try not to let that affect how you feel about yourself, that it niggles. So that's kind of a big digression here. What I'd like to do is go a little bit into what I talked about yesterday, the different eye movement skills, the different things that happen, and how they might come across as far as learning ability, and how they might limit things. I'm going to start with eye movements. Yesterday we had the picture of Nefertiti. And what we have on the right is, for Duane here, computer-generated with instrumentation now as to what the eye actually does as it tends to view an unfamiliar object. And picking up on the areas of highest interest, most curvature, most angles, the eye tends to return to again and again and tends to just make its... The short movements from one area to another are called saccades, little tiny movements. And typically the eye makes a very small movement, say in here, and then they do it, it does a fixation. It rests on that spot, registers, and it's a constant series of a little jump, fixation. The longer movements that we do, especially if you were reading text and you get to the end of a line and then go to the beginning of the next line, it's a pursuit. It's a long, sweeping movement. These eye movements are very, very critical, and the reason they are, again, is because this tiny dot here, this entire picture represents the fundus of the eye, the entire back of the eye that the eye doctor can see as he looks with his instrumentation, and to examine the health of your arteries. These are arteries and veins, okay? And this tiny little spot over here, away from the center of the optic nerves, actually. The macula has an even smaller area within it called the fovea centralis, and that's the area of your clear, sharp vision. It's that minute. So if the two eyes are not precisely aligned, then you don't have the binocularity, you don't have the depth perception. Not only do they have to align at the same point in time, maybe they do that, but maybe both eyes don't move smoothly when they do move. And when I screen people, sometimes I will have them cover one eye and trace their eye movements and watch what happens as they try to follow an object with that one eye. And very often, you'll see what they call a midline jerk. Well, they get partway over and then there's a little hiccup step, okay? What happens is, then maybe check the other eye, it may or may not have that problem. And then together, usually if the problem is there, it is there to some degree when the eyes are attempting to work together as well. What happens during the time that the eye's moving from side to side, if it's not smooth, if it has that little glitch in it, it interferes with this tracing pattern that's being registered neurologically in the brain. Okay, if the trace, each time you look at an object, maybe the word the, okay? The eyes go across it, you see the same basic shape. Of a letter that's not quite as tall, a taller letter, and a short one at the end. And you get that same image, your eyes as a child,
go over at the same time, and it's in the repeated tracings, neurological tracing to the brain, that you come to recognize that that's that word. Well, now the child who's got a little glitch in their eye movement is learning to read, and the word is house. And they go right across it, and they get the word house. And they say the word house as they're reading aloud to the parent or the teacher. A little bit later, next line, maybe two lines down, because this is a story that involves a house, the word appears again. But they've got a glitch. H-U-S-E. And they go, poof, huff. And the parent says, you just read that two lines ago. You know that word. Well, sure, they do. But their eyes are not giving them the same word. Their eyes are giving them another image. And who knows, the next time they read it, they may get H-O-S-E. And they are in deep trouble. And they're frustrated. And rightfully so. And the problem that often happens, as it did with my stepdaughter, is that we could see her intelligence. And we could, in all good-heartedness, say, just try harder, dear. We know you can do it. Mm-hmm. Poor kid was trying so hard. I think it was a real relief, you know, at the age of 20, when she finally realized that, hey, it's not me. I'm not dumb. That, you know, that's always a weight off the shoulders. Okay. The other thing that I made reference again to yesterday, but it bears repeating here, is what you're dealing with is sometimes omitting letters. Sometimes those irregularities of movement may produce duplicated letters. So all at once the word little has three T's in the middle of it, you know, or whatever. And this has nothing to do with can this child read the page? Can this child see the page? It has everything to do with what happens as the eyes move across the page and what happens in the connection between the eyes and the brain. One of the questions that usually comes up is the big D word, dyslexia. That's kind of a real hot topic, and I think it's an appropriate place to address it. The different professions have different definitions for what they refer to as dyslexia. Psychologists will tell you one thing, educators will tell you another, optometrists might tell you another. They all are aiming at the same thing, but it's still a pretty diffuse area, and it's difficult for everybody to get together. In general, most people think of, and fairly rightly so, the dyslexic situation as being the word on the paper is was, and it comes out saw. According to my optometrist, and I would say most of those that I have been privileged to study with in the last year, the number of cases where what he calls hard wiring, where there is a neurological glitch somewhere in the person's neurological wiring that says no matter what you do, no matter how wonderful the eye movements are, how consistent everything is, that is going to come out. That. Those cases are now estimated at about 1% by optometry. They don't think that a neurological dyslexia that is really hard and fast within the person's functioning system is that prevalent. They really think that there is much more of the situation of the person has the word was, WAS, and because they have erratic eye movements, they read a word over here, their eyes went to there, and looked forward. And their brain is simply recording what happened in the order in which it happened. And interestingly enough, eye movements are one of the easiest visual therapy skills in general to build back in, to help a person work, to learn. Now, we had a very interesting case that the last I heard was making very good progress. She was doing this type of thing, literally seeing things in reverse order, and that's all her brain was recording. The woman was in her early 20s and a very talented artist. She was going to art school. She had no problem with the courses, but she, as far as the physical hands-on, but she couldn't do the study. It just wasn't working for her. At the same time, she was too intelligent not to have that to round out her talent, so she was really caught in a bind. She wanted to progress in her field, and she couldn't. And she had, unfortunately, and I don't think it's totally unrelated, fallen into an alcoholic pattern. And there's another, the story of Ricky back there is another case where it's not uncommon, I think, for people who are deeply frustrated, trying very, very difficult, to begin looking for escape mechanisms. There is, that touches into tomorrow's session on psychology. I don't think it's unreasonable to think that something might not overlap. I don't think we live little isolated lives where one thing is happening here and it doesn't affect everything that we reach out and touch in other ways. Signs that a person is doing this, aside from maybe listening to them read and hearing the wrong word come out or a skipped small word like my husband tends to do, or especially under stress. Very often you'll see the person who has difficulty with eye movement learn to compensate and their head is going like this. Okay? Well, that prevents them from having to make their eyes work smoothly over that little blind glitch that's catching them. And that's how they've learned not to lose their vice. Okay? It's effective. And compensation is good because it allows the person to do what the person wants to do. The problem with compensation is that it is limiting. You cannot go beyond the degree of the compensation that you are able to build. So it's kind of a mixed blessing. It's wonderful, it allows you to do what you want to do, but it also inhibits you from being able to progress further. Okay, that was eye movements. Accommodation. Accommodation is the ability to change focus. From near to far. Here we have the person looking at the book, looking in the distance. Some of this is a little review from yesterday. I'll try to keep the review part to a minimum. When you change distances, you need to have clarity both at near and at far. It doesn't always happen that way, and that's where yesterday I referred to copying work from the chalkboard is one of the biggest places where that's going to come up. They look in the distance, it's not quite clear, they wait till it's clear, then they remember what they wrote. Uh-oh, it's not clear here. Get it clear, write it down, look up. Uh-oh, I got away from it. The measurable gap that we had, a case from my island, 4 seconds for each movement. Terribly inhibiting. She could compensate, but she was one very tired little girl. The other thing to do with accommodation that I haven't mentioned yet is
sometimes a person with poor accommodation skills can see the eye chart in the optometrist's office, can see it in the nurse's office, can read it, and then a few seconds later, the line that they just read, they can't read anymore. And if a doctor is not versed in behavioral optometry, sometimes that leads to miscommunication with the patient. And there was a 16-year-old diagnosed as learning disabled. Her mother brought her in to see me. We were going to have vision things on Monday. She was taking her to a regular eye doctor that day. As soon as she was done, she was going to come in and we were going to check her eye skills and see if there seemed to be anything there. She had gone in, read the chart, and within a very short period of time when the doctor was checking further for something, first of all, he said, well, I think your child just wants glasses because she doesn't appear to need them. And then later in the exam, that what she just read, she's not reading anymore, which didn't make sense to him. And in essence, he had called this girl a liar in the course of the exam. She was in tears. What she had was not the ability to sustain her accommodation. She'd get it, but it wouldn't stay. Okay. That can be addressed, but unfortunately her doctor wasn't up on or tuned into that type of a situation and did not know what he was dealing with and therefore assumed that since she was behaving in a way that didn't fit any pattern that was established, therefore, obviously, she's, you know, and it's an understandable error, but it's an unfortunate error. Signs of an accommodation problem, they may avoid reading, understandably. Another understandable result of this is excessive blinking. Gosh, just get it to clear. Sometimes if I blink, you know, it gets better. Complaints of blurring, moving the head closer to the book. Yeah, one little girl, I'm still not sure that she's really all right. She was taking her piano lesson and she had the music up there and she was playing and the next thing I knew here came and she is within 2 inches of the page. And by this time I was a little bit into visual things and I said, what's it look like when you get that close? And she said, it's pretty blurry. I said, well, I would think that it would be. But one thing I'm learning to do is not to say, don't do that, or what's wrong, but simply allow the person to report back what they experience, because everyone's visual system is individual. And they may not have anyone else that they can tell what they experienced. Anybody who is at least advised on these issues can become what some counselors call a safe container, a place where the person can say what they need to say and know that no matter how strange, it's going to be accepted and it's okay. Another thing that tends to happen with accommodation problems is they may get miss little short concepts that seem to be easy but grasp the big picture of things. You get that complex idea down when you don't seem to understand the little components of it. In the act of a person moving their eyes from here to here, we have just the right size of them today, so I have a little set of tests for you. We talked about how this is called convergence. Okay, the eyes. Convergence is the eyes come together to see what they need to see. Oh, thank you. To see what they need to see up close, and then the divergence of the eyes as compared to being close in order to see the tree in the distance. Well, in miniature, we're going to be able to see on each other how our eyes look when they're doing that. And we might learn a little bit something else in the process. Now my difficulty here is that I allow my strings to tangle. You're going to need to do this in pairs. There. And you'll want to unknot your strings, just a slip knot.
when you unknot your string here, try not to have beads fall off.
Okay.
I was going to warn other people not to go over the board. Yeah, sit facing each other. And I'm going to have you take the honor of hanging onto that end. You want to space these beads so that, let's see, you're person A here. You're person A, David, and you're person A, John. Okay? So space the beads so that person A has the closest one about 7 inches away from wherever they're grasping the string. Okay? And then just position the other beads out at maybe 10 inches.
About what?
About 10. Yeah. There.
Here
you go. Okay. Now, you want to be, fairly level with the other person. You take take the string over to your nose. Okay? Now, person A has the string at his nose. What I want you to do is focus on the closest bead to you. And your partner, watch their eyes as they narrow to focus on that. Did you get it? And if you...
Well, you're in the, I'm zeroing on the first bead.
Oh, you're zeroed in on the first bead, okay? What I would like to know from person A on each team is how many beads do you see and how many strings?
Two.
You get two beads?
Yeah, two strings.
And two strings. Yeah. What do you get?
Two beads.
Uh-huh.
One string.
Okay. David?
One bead and two strings.
Okay. Interesting, huh? Yeah. The same. Life is different. Okay, now let's rest the eyes a bit. Diverge them out to the furthest bead. Okay, so pull it back to your nose. Okay. What do you get out there, Oscar? How many beads, how many strings?
Probably two strings.
Okay. What do you get, David?
One bead and two strings.
Okay.
Do you mean this
bead? This
bead.
It can a further away bead, whichever one you want to focus on. What about you, John?
I get one bead and two strings.
Okay. Now, does anybody have their two strings making an X?
Making what?
An X,
yes.
Crossing.
Yes.
Do you have two strings?
Yeah.
Do they make an X?
I'm not sure.
Okay. That's fine.
Mine do.
Okay. Now, what I'd like you to do is trade. I'll explain the ramifications of this a little bit.
I've got one step.
It's changed. Okay, it's changed. That's not unusual. That's all fine, too. Okay, well, let's change partners. So B partner here is going to be able to look at the string at the bead. And Oscar, what you can do is stand behind John and observe her eyes, okay, as she focuses on the close bead first. Okay, Wayne? Okay, and now focus on the far bead. You see the shift that the person makes? Try it again. Close, a little bit inward, and then the far one. A little bit outward. Get down lower. Yeah. Try it again. Okay, if she's on the near bead.
And I'm zeroing on the far bead, right?
No, you're supposed to get the bottom. Okay. Okay, can you see this?
I'm looking at the first bead.
Can you see the difference in the convergence and divergence there?
Close.
Okay. Uh-huh. And far. Far further away. Which one?
It's just so slight.
You see the difference?
Yes, it's a very slight difference. And we're not usually used to
it. Did you, Oscar? Did you see any difference in my eyes? I'll look at the first one.
I think you would draw on the
analysis. Okay.
And the third one.
Yeah, I see the difference.
Okay, can you look back? With her, it looks more like a little up and down.
Well, yeah, probably. But, you know, I'm blind in one eye.
Okay.
I'm wondering if that makes any difference.
It makes it a little bit harder with the subtlety of movement. Yes, I would say that's true. Yeah, it made it harder for me with that one eye going.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Now, what happens for the people who saw two strings, where... did the strings appear to lead to on your face? Where did they appear to come from?
My eyes. Mm-hmm. My nose, right?
Did you? Okay. Do you recall? And if you don't recall, look again.
From the bead. It was going out on the bead.
Okay. So it's going the other way, but not toward you?
Yeah. Oh. Yeah.
Okay.
Is that what you mean?
Uh-huh. Well, yeah. See. Okay.
I see two strings, but I don't, they seem to, the focal there, and then they broaden out as
they come. Okay, they broaden out as they come toward you. Do you want to try again, David? Now, John, Oscar, since you've explained to me the situation for your left eye, I can pretty much predict what was going on here. Pull it up your nose, and you saw one string, right?
Oh, my God.
Yeah.
Okay. Where does it appear to lead to?
What am I supposed to, am I looking at you now? Or
are you supposed to focus on the bead? The first bead and the string. The string as it comes from the bead to you.
Yeah.
Where does it appear to come to you? What part of your body does it appear to come from?
Well, 3 inches up.
Okay. Does it point toward your left eye? The string?
Yes, it does.
Okay. Now, we would expect that that string, that we would see the string coming down from, and if you will close one eye as you do this now, which is the effect you had, you saw it coming as if it was coming from the other eye.
Yeah.
And you think you ought to be able to see it with that eye.
Yeah,
it does.
Isn't that interesting?
What did you say, Diane? What did you want to say?
Okay. What you want to know is
this eye closed.
Where does that, if you close your left eye.
Did I close the other one?
Uh-huh. Where does the same eye come to? Your left eye or your right eye?
Left eye.
Yeah, close your right eye. Okay. It's the opposite of what we would expect to perceive. So this can be a little confusing, because sometimes what is actually a correct visual perception is just fine, it's how you're supposed to work, doesn't click. It seems like I ought to see the right string with the right eye. After all, it's right there. And it's part of that physiological diplopia yesterday where we were looking at something near and noticing that made two of whatever was in the distance appear, and you look at the one single thing in the distance and it makes two fingers appear. It's a similar phenomenon. Okay. So related to that,
finish with beads.
Yeah. Related to that, this is compliments of Linda Sannett, who is a very active vision therapist in San Diego, California. And she wrote this as part of the training manual for vision therapists. Now, what a vision therapist is actually what I'm qualified to do at this time were I to choose. So, they work with a behavioral optometrist in their office. The behavioral optometrist, as he examines the patient, prescribes the lenses that are needed, works either on his own or with the vision therapist, or turns it over to her if she's very experienced. She designs, or he, or the optometrist does, the exact course of exercises and things, remedial program, basically, that's to be done to bring this person's visual system up to at least a level where they're going to be able to achieve their life goals. Some vision therapy offices can literally take you to what my doctor calls Olympic eyes. He can look at, he's got so much control over what his eyes do that he can pick up a piece of paper and say, okay, now it's double, now it's triple. He can do anything he wants with them. And that's that's handy, but like he says, most of us don't need to have that degree of visual functioning. What they do is develop a program that will allow that person more accessibility to reaching their particular goals, their circumstances. The vision therapist is the one who is actually in the therapy room with the patient. And what she does
is amazing. And at first glance, you think she's been assigned to sit and play games. The vision therapy room may have a balanced walking rail, it may have a trampoline, it may have a little, like a mesh catcher screen that you she can pitch little things into and, you know, have kids. It's got all sorts of stuff. It has eye-hand coordination and it looks like games. And that's good because you want, especially the young person, to thoroughly enjoy the process as much as possible. It is hard work. And when what appears to be a game for us as we watch the person, if that's a visual skill they don't have, it's not a game. And they're usually trying to get them to work at a level where they're going to be challenged. They're not going to be bored by what's been given to them because then they wouldn't be growing any. But they can't give them such a heavy visual demand that they're going to be frustrated and shut down and say, I don't want to do this. So they're walking that fine line that all teachers walk of, how do we challenge and motivate without overloading? Okay. Linda Sanett asks if we could solve the problem. We've got triangle ABC with our angles. Okay, we know it's a triangle. They give us, this is a 45, a 45, okay? They give us the angles. They give us that line C and D is perpendicular. And they give us the length of this side. And what we're supposed to determine is the length of line C and D. And fortunately, as she wrote her thing, she quickly went to the next thing and said, before you groan, you don't have to do it, okay? But our mind does this every day. If points A and B are your eyes, okay, left and right eyes, then this distance here is the pupillary distance between your two eyes. This is the object of regard, they call it, whatever point in space you choose to look at. Our mind automatically calculates how far away that is for us on an everyday type of basis. And of course that changes. You take one step and you just change that distance. This, you know, when you think about how sophisticated our functioning is and how helpful it is if that is working easily, if it's not blurry, if it shifts as it should.
Looking at that, the one vision I get, you know, is of a triangle with a line up in the center.
Uh-huh.
But the other vision is of a two-sided, what would you call it?
Pyramid?
Pyramid.
Oh.
Does anybody else get that?
What was your first one?
First is a triangle with a you know, dividing. Uh-huh. The other vision I get is the two sides of the pyramid.
I can make it happen if you say it, and I look for it, I can see it then.
I'm not sure that I'm totally grasping it. Does somebody use other words to help?
Three-dimensional.
Okay. You can. Yeah, I see.
Three-dimensional, if you ask her?
So could you could imagine maybe that this is either toward you or away from you, this middle line?
Well, A had to go in and then A and B actually coming in.
Yeah. Maybe I should turn it off so that
that's probably like that, the word Jesus, have you seen that?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, in the needlework.
You can't figure it out.
Mm-hmm. Oh, right, you can see it in two ways. It's kind of like the old picture of the vase and the faces that they use in psychology books. And matter of fact, they do quite a bit of that in vision therapy. They'll put things up and you know, allow you to work on being able to see things two ways. It's an interesting situation. I'd like to talk a little bit about then. Here we've talked a lot about the teaming of the two eyes and how working together that helps. Now, there are
different approaches, obviously, to correcting a situation where somebody has what they call a wandering eye, or walleye, or crossed eyes, where they're just not obviously lined up together. Surgery is often used, and last summer I went to a regular optometric conference. There were some behavioral presentations, but the bulk of it was straight optometry, and they had a presentation by a man who is both an optometrist and an MD who is doing eye surgery. And I sat there and I thought, I don't want to see this. He had his slides up and it had all the colors. And I'm very glad that I did, because eye surgery now isn't some obscure thing to me. I know what they do, how they try to actually do succeed in lengthening or shortening given muscles, how they make the decision. There are six muscles that surround each eye that control movements. And they, by lengthening or shortening those muscles, can definitely change the direction in which the eye points. At the beginning, I showed you that tiny, tiny area within the back of the eye called the macula, where our vision focuses. The difficulty that we have with surgery is that the probability of the surgeon being so accurate that when he gets the person lined up, they have both of those in concert is about 10%. Mm-hmm. It's a very hard angle to hit because it's such a finite distinction. Now they do use a new thing called an adjustable stitch, which literally, after they finish the surgery, they can then, after the bandages are off, take a look, see what the result is, and take some of that tension out. And they're finding ways to be a little more precise. I think that sometimes in surgery they come so close that the person does get fusion, but I think that without the vision training to help them get used to utilizing that and to know what they are supposed to see, that often it's easier to go back to the world they knew. Like the poor man Virgil, who was blind and then they restored his sight. It was such an amazing adjustment psychologically that there's part of you that doesn't know that it wants to go into that. There are two teams in the Puget Sound area where an optometrist and an ophthalmologist have actually gone into practice together. And their idea is we can do vision therapy before surgery, get that person controlling their eyes as much as possible, and then we can do the surgery, and then we can follow it with more therapy to assist them and give them a better result, because vision therapy can't work in every case, just like surgery can't work in every case. One of these partnerships just formed, and it'll be fun to watch it and see how it goes. There are a lot of cases. Surgery was actually suggested in mine, not because I had an obvious eye turning out, except when I was tired, and it did. It took a walk in the evening. My husband could look over and go, well, she's wearing out. You know, I was obviously watching the television with one eye. But on day to day, no one had any idea that I had one eye that wasn't functioning. And the doctor, one ophthalmologist, said, you know, I said, is there anything that I can do about the situation? He said, well, if it bothers you, we can always operate. I don't think it bothers me quite that much, and I don't have to how many $1,000s it takes anyway. I'm glad that they didn't, because one of the drawbacks of surgery is scar tissue. And doing physical eye movement exercises where you have to learn to use those muscles in a different way is made much more difficult if you've got scar tissue interfering with, you know, the quote normal elasticity of the muscle. Usually it is not, in the behavioral point of view, a muscle weakness.
The muscles that control the eye have plenty of strength to move up in any direction. It's simply a matter of development. Some of the development things I've really gone through recently with my best friend who at the age of 42 had her first baby. And I said, Deborah, we're going to know this kid has got every chance visually as she starts her life. And I gave her things to read and we talked. Things that in the days when people always breastfed was almost always taken care of. The baby fed on one side, the baby fed on the other side. One eye usually being so close to the parent that it really wasn't able to do much work. Okay, the other eye would be focusing on mommy. But then mommy changed sides almost immediately and that eye would be occluded and the baby was working the other eye. You bottle feed and often you're right-handed and there you are. You're already allowing that infant the possibility of simply being bored, not having to use one eye. The other things that they recommend are place the baby in the crib, sometimes the head this way, sometimes the head that way if you put them on their tummies. And I'm not into pediatrics, so I don't know about all those, whether you should put them on the tummy or back stuff. But move the crib to different positions in the room so they get different visual stimuli. So they don't have a boring wall and all of what mommy and daddy do over here. Okay, so you can encourage a balance in their visual system because it is a gradually learned process. And if they don't have any reason to use both eyes, there's a possibility that it's just, okay, no. It could happen. There is even a book, wonderful little book, called Enhancing Your Child's Development, where the woman has done 30 years of wonderful work on the connection between the muscle movement, the crawling abilities. We all have heard some of the things about the children who don't crawl the right to walk and sometimes have other problems. Sometimes those problems are visual, too. And she would maintain they're frequently visual. And it's because of her own daughter that she got into this. Another case where it's supposed to be just a little slow, don't worry about it, mom, and the kid never caught up. And they finally, between a combination of doing the gross body movements, getting her coordinated and using her body in these means, and the vision therapy, got her out of that situation. So I kind of alluded there to suppression, maybe predetermining in some subtle way without realizing it that child doesn't have to use one eye. There's another kind of suppression that can go on. There's lots of them. There's lots of little flavors to all of these things, but it's called alternate suppression, where the person actually works off of this eye and then off of this eye, and they're switching back and forth. They may do it on, you know, within a period of seconds, or it may be a longer term. I had a friend on Orcas Island who had totally normal vision, had an eye injury. They patched his eye for quite a period of time while it healed. It was quite an injury. He said he was very lucky, he had an excellent surgeon, and he got the full sight of the eye back.